From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
As she often does, naturalist and nature writer Nancy Lawson, perhaps known better to some of you as the Humane Gardener after the title of her first book, caught my attention the other day. "My yard isn't overgrown and neither is yours," Nancy wrote in a post on Instagram. What she went on to say is that words like overgrown are the kind that are often applied negatively to landscapes that don't fit the manicured model, the one dominated by the mindset of the great American lawn. But Nancy Lawson takes exception, countering with the thought that most landscapes are in fact undergrown, as in lacking diversity and life. More in a moment with Nancy, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Naturalist Nancy Lawson is author of The Humane Gardener and then also of the book Wildscape. When she and her husband bought their Maryland home almost 25 years ago, it was anything but a wildscape, and she vividly remembers that the 2.23 acres featured, in her words, almost 2 acres of mowed turf and a little tiny sickly rose bush. Not anymore. I'm so glad to welcome her back to the program today. Hi, Nancy. How is it down there in the wildscape in Maryland? Good.
Hi. Yes, it's excellent. The birds are all in their heated bird baths outside. And
yeah, lots of birds this year. We've had a cold snap, and boy, some days just morning doves alone, there'd be 40 or 45 morning doves besides everybody else. You know, there'd be over 100 birds at a time, you know, visiting to drink. I keep water available as well.
And
it's fun. Makes it all make sense a little bit or something.
I love to watch them lining up, taking their turns at the bird bath.
And the literal pecking order, like some species are bossier than others.
Yes.
Who's in charge?
Sure.
Yeah. So as I said in the introduction, your recent post on Instagram is where I had originally seen it, but it's on your website in more depth. It really caught my ear. And I want to first set the scene for those who may not have read it. And, you know, you start with, "My yard isn't overgrown and neither is yours." In fact, if you're like most Americans, I'd venture to say that it's more likely undergrown. So how did this topic come up right now? And tell us a little more about what you wrote about in brief.
Yeah, I've been thinking about these kinds of words for a long time. I think I reached my breaking point with the word overgrown when my sister was going through her HOA case, where they were coming after her for her pollinator garden, which she eventually managed to save and help get a state law passed.
And so this was her homeowners association. Other people complained, and this was a case in Maryland that became kind of a test case, a really important case. Yes.
Yeah. And our county, our state delegates in our county took it on and drafted some legislation to prevent this from happening to other people living in HOAs, and it passed. So it turned into a great way of making lemonade from lemons. But I think, you know, during that time, certainly a lot of the citations my sister had been getting called her garden overgrown. And whenever people contact us about citations they get either from their HOA or from weed inspection agencies, that's typically one of these sort of fighting words, I call them, that are used. And And so I just started to think about what is an alternative to that in terms of how we can reframe this discussion, because it's almost like people use it as a default. And as I noted in my article on my website, when the New York Times did a sort of their a daily email digest that week that they wrote about Janet's case and about a year ago, the person writing the email described her that she won the fight to keep her overgrown garden or something like that. And he'd never seen it. He'd just probably given the article a cursory read. And it just struck me that it was a way that he had chosen to write his little teaser, and it's not even the way that the reporter Cara Buckley, who wrote the article, described her garden, but it's just so embedded in our minds that a lawn is a quote unquote tidy and normal and pretty, and that anything else is overgrown.
Right. So, it got me thinking, your post and both the Instagram and the longer one on the website, on the Humane Gardener website, it got me thinking, like, really of how tricky the subject and the language around gardening has become. And you and I have talked about this offline a little bit, but I want to talk about it out loud a little bit too. Especially in the last decade, I've been, gardening for probably 40-ish years or something, and I've been writing about it for 30 something of those years, I guess. And the tension between sort of our one-time image of a garden, which used to be, take derived from sort of the English, the pretty picture books. It was sort of a place where control was a virtue, and it was all about like a pretty picture perfect place scene that was created. And then now, fast forward, we've learned so much more about the ecosystems and about habitat, creating habitat, and the other things that we can do as gardeners, besides make pretty pictures. And not to say that we shouldn't make pretty pictures. I'm not saying it should be either or, and that's the thing. And so now, as you and I have talked about, if I write a story about something native in the New York Times garden column or even on the blog, some of the people get mad because they want to know, they think it looks, quote, the word they usually use is messy. I don't want something messy. And then if I write about non-native things that are what we used to call ornamental, then everybody gets mad who says, but that's not native. Why are you writing about
Right,
it? Sorry, that was long-winded, but you know what I mean. It's this tension, and you're right, part of the language, there's a lot of triggering, to use a contemporary word, triggering language too.
And there was when I posted that post last week on Facebook, there was a lot of response from people who were excited about maybe having a new way to talk about things with that word undergrown. One of the negative comments that I got was from a guy who was really upset that I didn't provide substitute words. And it, you know, the whole point is that these are, we don't have to see everything always, we don't have to label everything. We don't have to see everything always in such black and white terms. And so for me, a substitute term is sort of missing that whole point. And it got me thinking about the fact that there are a lot of renaming campaigns now, like with renaming the Audubon Society and renaming bird names. And those, you do need a substitute. You do need another word for if you're going to change the name of a bird who's named after somebody from the 18th century, and you want to make it a more human friendly and bird friendly species name now. But these other words, a lot of them that I was talking about in that post are conceptual words. So, you know, you don't need a substitute for an opossum. You don't need to call that a possum. You know, if you're calling that opossum a pest, well, he already has a name. He's an opossum. If you're calling a violet a weed, well, the violet already has a name. The violet is a violet. And so it's more about like looking at how we categorically lump things together as either good or bad, and just trying to see if people can take a step back from that.
Right. Right. As I said, one of the other words that I'm often assaulted with is, you know, that looks messy. And you know, I was thinking about, well, what do they mean? Messy? Do they mean kind of wildish, or do they mean loose? Do they mean you're looser than formal? Do they mean naturalistic? Do they mean full, bountiful? Could we, do you know what I mean? Could we,
yeah,
could we like free associate a little bit?
Yeah.
Stop just slandering one another and yelling at each other.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all. I you know, and I agree with you that we shouldn't necessarily have to, because a violet is a violet and opossum is an opossum. But the scene, the overall scene, as opposed to holding on to a picture on that only one picture, a formal, rigid, well-mown and manicured, you know, to the nth degree picture is the only picture that's okay. Could we instead think about words like looser and naturalistic and full and bountiful? Could we think about those words as opposed to
right,
overgrown, messy?
yeah, for sure. I mean, that's if, but I think when people who are using the word messy, they don't even have the naturalistic vocabulary in their head though, do they?
No, you're right.
They're thinking straight lines, flat mode. And so, I mean, it's sort of like there's the absence of it, and then there's the abundant presence of it. And when people are thinking in those two extremes, that those are the words they fall back on.
Yeah, in your blog post, you had an interesting made an interesting point, which is that, you know, you say in it, if you have a turf grass lawn on most of your property, your yard isn't in fact pristine, it's undergrown. And then you say, if you or your lawn service company apply herbicides, insecticides, synthetic fertilizers, your yard is not immaculate, it's contaminated. So, yeah. Right? I mean, we can, either set of language we can look at in a different way, and it's not immaculate. There's another story behind it, which is that we've killed off a lot of the life to make it behave that way. Yeah, we've subdued it. We've subdued things into submission. I mean, by that I mean into submission.
Right, and it partly has to do with some of these things that, if we're only looking at what's right in front of us, in not considering the more hidden effects, and then you know what people do see is something appealing, although I don't know why that's appealing to them, just a big expanse of green grass, but it's just what people are used to, I think. But so there's the sight problem, where they're not thinking about things that could be out of their view, the consequences. But then there's also, you know, thinking from the perspective of the other organisms, the other living beings who have to share that land, and how they might see it or sense it in different ways.
Which is so much what your second book, Wildscape, is about. It is about listening and smelling and touching and tasting and so forth, in behalf of all the creatures, like really letting our perceptions, our doors of perceptions, open up, you know, in their behalf. You say something else interesting in this blog post, which is that, you know, over the years, as you've explored these sort of these false dichotomies that have been set up language-wise, and you've asked scientists even, you know, like, why do we say this? Why do we say that? And one was pest versus beneficial insect. Tell us about that one. How did we end up doing that, setting them up as if there's two sets of insects?
Yeah, I was struck by that when I did my first master gardener training in 2005, and I had already been working at the Humane Society for a few years and was very aware of the damage that the words pest and nuisance can cause in relation to mammals in terms of people's perceptions of them. And then I took this class, and, you know, there's whole sections of the manual on pest insects and beneficial insects. And, you know, the first question is, well, beneficial to whom and pest to whom? Because there were a lot of insects in there that we know are actually beneficial to birds and other animals that were being labeled as pests. And so I asked a couple of different entomologists when I did my first book where that came from. And they were just like, well, it's basically a marketing term. And it's to try to get people to like some insects. Mm-hmm. At least like some insects and mm-hmm. leave them alone. So there was a positive intent behind trying to come up with that word beneficial. But I think it just makes people, it often makes people, you know, say anytime they meet a new insect in their garden, oh my gosh, is this good or bad? And it sets up that binary thinking right away. And if they go look online, they might learn that it's bad when it's really not.
Right. Well, where's the line of, I mean, yeah, where's the line of demarcation, so to speak, if you have a black to white, a negative to positive, you know, a continuum, like, where do you put the, where's the spot where you go over the edge? And I mean, with the beneficial, I get why they say it was a marketing thing, and it's worked in the sense that otherwise I sort of, you know, all the images I have of people are like that scene in the Annie Hall movie or whatever, you know, where there's a spider in the bathroom and she sends Woody Allen in to get her or whatever, but this sort of, everyone is terrified of, you know, arthropods, insects and other arthropods, everyone, you know,
yeah,
well, of most animals, frankly. And so I guess I'm glad that they put a spin on some of them, but it has maybe backfired by this point. Yes. Yeah. As well.
And as you're talking about it, I hadn't really thought about this in this way before, but, you know, so take it, for example, a caterpillar. I have this, you know, there's golden, what are they called? Golden guides that were printed.
Yes, sure. Yes.
Yeah. Golden so guides, when I was little, I would buy them at the grocery store.
Yeah.
I still have one called Pests, you know, and it has caterpillars in it, like butterfly caterpillars. And they're, you know, they're in the pest book. And it's not that people call them now beneficial either, but they don't call them pests anymore. Like that's, you know, because they know that they feed birds and they've.
Yes, know. Just because they bite holes in some of your plants doesn't mean that they're pests. The ones that destroy an entire native species of trees, for example, I think those deserve to remain in the pest category. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think the hemlock woolly adelgid is a pest insect. It's a little bit different kind of animal. Yeah.
Although the use of the word, though, I know what you're saying, but I just think about the fact that, like, okay, so where that animal is from, they're not probably a pest.
No, absolutely not. But out of, and that's why I think when we speak about invasive or alien or whatever you want to call it, imported, however we want to speak about it, it's important to understand that when it's not in its natural habitat, it gets out of control. It's not that it's innately out of control. It's right. That humans have transported into a place where it's speaking of that pecking order that we started about the birds, right. It's out of the order is not here. And they are strangers in a strange land. And Right. And it's gone to hell, you know. So that's you also, you know, talk about another sort of really loaded and confusing word, which is weed, which is so like, I mean, you know, I have clear weed and jewel weed, you know, which clear weed pilea, and and jewel weed, you know, an impatient species, you know, plants that I love, and that lots of creatures here, insects as well as in the case of the jewelweed, the hummingbirds, you know, but their names, their common names are, have weed in them.
Yeah. And I can't remember if we talked about this before, but, you know, I when I first started gardening here, I ripped out jewelweed and pokeweed because of their names, and because I would see them listed as weeds, and I didn't know any better. So it's definitely harmful, for sure, to have them in their common names. And then it's, over the years, you know, it's made me, I try not to use that word. I try to avoid it no matter what, because I think it's so confusing to people. And so, you know, if I'm talking about something like a ground ivy or a creeping Charlie, I'll say, you know, a non-native that can, you know, push out natives and take over wildlife habitat. Now, that's a long thing to say, but at least it's more precise.
Yeah, I'm still back on the sort of non-native thug. My short version is non-native thug for some of those ground covers that we erroneously we introduced. Again, a lot of them were introduced either accidentally or because we thought they were going to be good garden plants, and they've gotten out of control. So, you know, I think of them as non-native thugs, but same intention to what you said. Yeah.
Right.
So you want to start I assume that the reason that you wrote about it is that you want to do it out. You want to talk about this out loud, right? I mean, you want, this is an important conversation for us all to have, rather than just condemn overgrown yards and think that's going to get us anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've been doing my talks based on, like, I started doing talks on this vocabulary framework around 2013 or so. Mm-hmm. Before I wrote my first book, and then I used that framing as some of what I wrote about in there. But I realized I'd never really put it all in one place. And so it's been bothering me that I don't have it written down like that somewhere. So I wanted to, and also since then, you know, I've added more words to my pet peeve words. I do think, you know, we spent a lot of time in my sister's HOA case dismantling some of those words, both like at the hearings and in the newsletters to the community and stuff. And I do think that when people start to think about it, some people get upset, but I didn't hear from as many of those this time as I have on some of the other things I've posted. For the most part, even people who have a lot of lawn are saying, yeah, you know, you really made me think about this. Or I've been wondering how to frame this. Or, so I would like to be able to just kind of see these words loosen up a little. And if not totally go away, because that's probably not realistic, just at least try to have people talking in a more expansive way about the plants and animals around them.
Mm. Yeah. So in the last minute or two, I feel like, again, I want to go outside when the snow and ice melt, and I want to free associate about what I'm seeing. I want to think of the new, do you know what I mean? The different adjectives. I mean, I feel like it's an exercise we could all do. Maybe with the, I'm going to do a book giveaway of Wildscape with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com of your second book. And maybe what we'll do is the question that people have to answer to enter to win the book will be, to free associate about one of these words with us. So I'll think about that. But
that's a great idea.
Yeah. So let's get some help with this, right?
Yeah.
So in the last minute or two, so what else is kind of on your mind right now? It's this, you wanted to get this down, and what else is top of mind right now?
Well, I have something in the works on color. Yeah, and how our culture is so geared toward the neutrals and the historical reasons for that, because I've been reading some things about that, and I just think it's really interesting how it might apply to our landscape choices, conventional landscape choices.
Anyway. Oh, yeah. Not a subject I know anything about. Interesting. I have a lot of screaming gold stuff, so I'm maybe in the other end of the.
Yeah, I think you are.
My house is dark green with reddish orange trim, so I might be on the other end of the crazy.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm always glad to speak to you, and like I said, I was really glad to read this just because things have changed, and sometimes I'm not quite sure how to. I'm not sure if I have my footing. You know, I see the comments, and like the ones you get sometimes too that you were speaking about, and I don't know, am I missing something? And I want to open up and think more widely, and do a lot of this free associating and stuff. So it was provocative to me what you wrote, and I thank you for it.
Thank you so much for your interest. I love talking with you, Margaret.
All right, well, we'll talk soon, and yeah, thank you. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and thinking about the language of gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.